My guest at this time is Ed Whalen. He's the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center here in Washington, and he's a former Supreme Court law clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. He's also, as you might imagine, been very closely following the Supreme Court oral arguments this week as it relates to various aspects of the president's health care law. And we want to get his analysis now of what he heard, what stood out to him, and what he thinks the verdicts might be in these four different arguments that were heard. And Ed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Obviously, the amount of time devoted to arguments over these various aspects was, it's not unprecedented, but it's certainly unique in the modern age. What do you think we learned most of all as these arguments unfolded about where the justices seem to stand here?
Well, we learned a number of things. I think we learned, first of all, that there are five justices who are deeply concerned about some very fundamental questions involving the Obamacare legislation. There are five justices who are possible votes to strike down the mandate on the so-called severability question, perhaps to strike down the entire legislation or very large parts of it. I emphasize the word possible. This is just an oral argument, and it would be a mistake to infer too much from questions. We'll have to see whether those possible votes turn into actual ones, but certainly the conventional wisdom among many that this would be an easy case or that these questions weren't serious ones, I think was amply disproven by the oral arguments.
One of the things that some folks had concluded prior to the oral arguments is that your former boss, Justice Scalia, had a general track record of being pretty favorable to the government in exercising Commerce Clause power. Did you have questions about where he'd likely direct most of his questioning in these hearings?
Well, I think some folks had misread one opinion of his as being far broader in import than it was. Justice Scalia has joined some opinions that are more restrictive of Commerce Clause authority. I was certainly interested to see how he would approach this case, and I think that he's made quite clear that the authority under the Necessary and Proper Clause of the Constitution is not unlimited in the way that some people think it is.
And how much do the oral arguments matter? We know, for example, that Justice Thomas rarely asks questions in oral arguments because he believes he can usually render a decision based on the volume of written material that comes to his desk. So based on your experience at the court, can a lot of minds be changed by the way that the hearings go? Or is it usually based on what they've already combed through in all the briefs and so forth?
Well, it's difficult to say. My impression is that it varies an awful lot. And that the attention of the justices can really be grabbed by advocates who either make some fine or sharp distinctions or those who are unable to do so. Here, I think what was remarkable is that the government failed time after time to identify any meaningful limiting principle on congressional authority. And I think it was clear that that failure troubled a number of the justices. So I think that, look, it's difficult to, in a big case like this, there's a lot to sort through, and the briefs are going to require careful study. But I think that the whole point of oral argument is to isolate attention on key issues and really press the advocates to provide answers that they haven't perhaps provided in their briefs. And on that score, I think that the challengers to the Obamacare legislation had an excellent week. In particular, former Solicitor General Paul Clement did an outstanding job in all the arguments in which he took part.
Donald Verrilli's taken a lot of heat for not having the greatest performance, stumbling at times, coughing at times. It sounds like from what you're saying, though, that the bigger problem might be with the argument than the presentation.
Yes. I mean, Solicitor General Don Verrilli is an outstanding lawyer. And I think those who fault him, I think they're blaming the messenger rather than when they ought to be blaming the message. The problem here is that you have a position on the part of the administration that really is essentially unlimited. Look, that's been the default position of many for decades. So it's not surprising that a lot of people are comfortable with it. But clearly there are five justices who had some real deep concerns about that, and I don't think they got good answers to their concerns.
And we also want to get your insights into where this goes from here. From the reports that we've heard, the justices could basically decide these various questions as early as tomorrow, and then, of course, the rest of the time till June, whenever they release their ruling, done to focus on putting all the opinions together. Walk us through that process. How will this work if, in fact, that happens tomorrow, and then all the work that you as a clerk used to have to do and today's clerks will have to do to put this all together?
At the end of each argument week, they have a conference. Actually, sometimes they have one earlier in the week for the early argued cases, but I think they have a conference scheduled for tomorrow, at which they will do a preliminary, somewhat even tentative statement of their votes. That will enable the Chief Justice or the Senior Justice in the majority, if it's not the Chief, to assign to a Justice the responsibility for drafting the opinion in the case. I will say that a lot can happen from that stage on. So you'll have, as of tomorrow internally, you'll have a sense of which way the case is going. But it doesn't always end up that way. And, big case like this with lots of different issues, I think we'll have to wait. Obviously we'll have to wait till late June to find out what really happens. But, there could be some twists and turns internally between now and then. We won't see those. We'll simply, learn what the court has decided when it issues its opinion at the end of June.
How late in the game could a justice potentially change their mind and swing the ruling?
Well, in theory, it could be any time right up till issuance. In practice, that would happen sometime after the majority opinion circulates. There have even been times when the justice assigned the majority opinion has decided that he's changed his own mind. So if it's 5-4, he would then be writing for the other four. So, in theory, that could happen any time. It's most likely, I think, to happen sometime between now and mid-May. But again, we'll never know of that till books are written about this case well after the fact. We'll simply see what happens publicly in late June.
All right, real quickly before we let you go, Ed, predictions on how this is likely to come down. First of all, the first argument that was heard on Monday was whether the court should hear this at all and whether this was a tax or not. What do you expect the rulings to be there?
Well, the consensus there seems to be that the court will go on and decide the case, so that it will not deem there to be a jurisdictional bar, and I have no reason to dispute that consensus.
And then, of course, the big issue that was argued Tuesday was the individual mandate. Sounds like, from what you said a little bit earlier in our conversation, that you're hedging your bets towards that it will be struck down.
I'm going to hedge it even more than that and make no prediction at all. So I'm very leery, and I know it's lots of folks like making predictions. I'm very leery of making predictions based on oral argument. So, too close to call.
And that, I guess, means that the severability one's too close to call. We don't have a final argument or a final decision yet on the mandate. So,
well, that's right. So even then, the severability argument proceeded on the assumption that the mandate was invalid. And the question then is how much of the bill of the law gets struck down. But, again, I find that a very difficult issue to sort out. I think the administration itself conceded that a lot of the bill, a lot of the law would fall. The challengers sought to have basically all the law fall. We'll see. There's also a possibility the court assigned one attorney to argue for the position that nothing else falls but the mandate. So that the argument there really didn't leave things very clear. So I'm not going to hazard a guess on that either. Sorry.
That's all right. A lot of work ahead, and as we've established over the last couple of days, could be some very complicated decisions. Might not be all that nice and neat, depending on how the justices come down on this. But we'll see in just a matter of weeks. Ed, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Greg. If I could make one final point, it's
sure.
That no matter what, opponents of Obamacare need to continue to make the political case against Obamacare, work for its political repeal. We don't know what's going to happen in June. We need to continue to fight for political repeal, to elect a Congress and a president who will enact sound health care reform and get rid of this monstrosity.
Ed, again, appreciate your time very much.
Thank you, Greg.
Ed Whalen is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center here in Washington. He's also a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.